tonight?
Carol Casella is a practicing physician, and in addition to her newest book, Gemini, is the national best-selling author of two other novels, Oxygen and Healer.
Carol is a founding member of the Seattle Seven, serves on medical boards working in Nicaragua and Bhutan, and mother of two sets of twins.
Interviewing Carol this evening is veteran journalist Floyd McKay. After years with the NBC affiliate in Portland and a stint at Harvard, Floyd taught journalism at WWU, where he is now professor emeritus. Please help us welcome Floyd McKay and Carol Casella.
Well, Carol, I reckon you're about the third author we've had on this program who's set at least a major part of the novel in the Olympic Peninsula. We had David Gooderson on here, Jonathan Everson, and now you. What is it that draws you to that area as a setting for a good book?
Well, I guess we could also ask, why does Chuckanut choose us? It's much cheaper for travel costs, of course, to just bring those of us who live locally here. How can you live here and not want to write about it, not want to describe it, not to mention no moment is the same? You know, walk through the Olympic Forest on a sunny day, walk through it on a snowy day or rainy day, which most of the days are, and every day is different. So it's wonderful to write about.
It's your character who's headquartered there, Bo, is a Janie is a young woman and who has a tragic accident, mm-hmm. and then is in the hospital, and we see what happens to her, but there's all sorts of flashbacks and everything. She meets with Bo, this young man, and he's from Seattle and comes from a totally different situation. We're talking a lot these days about inequality. There's a lot of that shown in this book.
There is. One of the main characters is Rainey. She goes by the nickname Rainey. And she grows up on the Olympic Peninsula in an old logging town, a small logging town. And one of the reasons I chose that setting was it's so glorious there. You have all these beautiful forests and coasts and these gorgeous resorts. And then you also have the more indigenous community that is suffering a lot, particularly in this economy. So I chose Rainey in part for that reason. She's being raised by her grandfather, who's quite eccentric. He believes the end of the world is right around the corner. And she meets one summer a young man named Bo. She is 13 and he is 12, and they stumble into adolescent love in their own awkward way.
And yet, and she come after this accident, she does get good medical care in Seattle, despite the fact there's not much on the peninsula.
Right. Rainey grows up, and we follow her through alternating chapters as she matures, and eventually she ends up being a patient in the book. She's an unidentified victim of a hit-and-run accident. She's life-flighted to a place like Harborview, where a physician takes care of her as she struggles with being on the, you know, the cusp of life and death, and modern medical technology comes in and tries to save her. So there's that contrast, too.
And that's where she meets her other protagonist, the doctor who's in charge of her care. This book has many levels. One of those levels that's of interest to people of a certain age, I guess, is because it deals with the end of life. Rainey is young, of course, but the end of life issue is, well, it's eternal, I guess. But this is of particular interest, I think, to you as a physician, right?
It is. It's an interest of mine as a physician and as an aging person and as a daughter of aging parents and even just being at that age range where now I have friends who are beginning to die of cancer and other diseases. And it's something I think we need to talk about more. I think we've gotten to a point in our society where we've made death a little bit invisible. Our grandparents don't die at home. Most of us die in nursing homes or hospitals. Our children survive now. They never used to. Even our pets aren't really allowed to die at home anymore. And so we've kind of lost, I think, some of our capacity to recognize that it's a natural part of the cycle of life. And doing it well is important. It's as important as being born well.
She's young, and we don't often think of how do we deal with the end-of-life situation for young people. I mean, we expect it of old people. It's inevitable, but a young person, they all seem invincible, and we treat them that way, don't we?
Yeah, I think so, and which is a little another luxury, I think, of the modern era. And part of what the book is also looking at is now that we have so much medical care, medical technology that really can alter the natural course of life and death, more of us do live into the end of life. I'm not sure we always have yet the ethical wherewithal to know what to do with that power. Are we always using it well? Are we always thinking about how and when to apply it?
How well prepared are most physicians to deal with this?
Not. You're not. Maybe more so now. When I was in training, I had one class, which was an elective, which ever talked about the ethics of death and dying. I was never instructed in how to talk to patients about it. And I think, if anything, even though there's probably more of that going on in our education now, in younger medical students' education, I think it's even more of a problem now because you have these huge teams taking care of patients in the ICU. The average ICU patient has 10 specialists taking care of them. So it's hard to even know who's in charge, who's going to sit down with the family and have this conversation that needs to be done on a very intimate level over multiple conversations.
We are becoming a less religious society also. Does that take the religious element more out of the death and dying and throw more of the burden onto people like physicians?
That's a really good question. I think it does. I think we don't have our ministers, our priests, our rabbis to consult with as much to help hold our hands as we go through that. And I don't think, as I said, as families, we're always necessarily talking about it enough. So there have been surveys that show that the average person who has a terminal illness is not told that by their physician or not in time to be able to make plans.
When is the right time?
I'll tell you what, I'm going to break the rules here. I think we should be talking about it now when we're all healthy and young. We should be talking about it in our families with our friends so that our friends and family know how we feel about these things because they'll be making those decisions for us largely.
When does a physician need to tell the patient about what's happening, how bad it is?
Well, I think we don't credit our patients enough with being able to take news like that. I think our patients and their families want our information. I think they want our guidance. I don't think they want to have to turn to Google. They want our perspective. I think physicians are often afraid to do that. They're afraid of the repercussions. They're afraid of taking the responsibility for potentially guiding people into a decision whose consequences may be unknown. But that's part of our job. That's part of our role in society.
How's the new system of affordable health care going to change some of these things? Do you think in any way it will change the way that doctors relate to patients?
Oh, such a small topic to bring up here, Floyd.
I have a
luckily,
motive here.
Yeah.
Luckily, wait on.
Speaking in the right part of the country about this. Well, as you may know, we had a bill that was proposed as part of the ACA to allow payment for these conversations to occur. They are time-consuming. People should be and rewarded for doing that, not just financially, but allowed the time to make the time with these families. That was removed in part because of political squabbling that went on. It was really a political argument that took that bill out of the language of the ACA.
You, one of your roles is you serve on a health panel for the Wall Street Journal. I have to ask you this. You wrote a column in which you advocated a single-payer system. How did that go down at the Wall Street Journal?
Well, funny. You know, I just sort of write the column, push it out there, and then go my merry way. But, you know, why preach to the choir, right? So I, you know, I'll defend it. I believe that's really the only answer we have for simplifying the system, cutting some of the wasted money. We waste a huge amount of money in our healthcare system, and part of it, a large part of it, is on administrative costs of having numerous insurers, different rules. Try to understand your own insurance bill. I dare you.
I've traveled a little bit in Europe, and occasionally we get ill or something like that. You go into a place, and there just isn't the same paperwork and huge staff and this sort of thing. You just deal with it.
Right.
The another one of your roles is you are the, I believe, the associate editor of the literature section for the anesthesiologist. What kind of books do anesthesiologists read?
Actually, I edit a small section of the academic journal Anesthesia, in which our members can write poetry or essays, creative writing. And it's been wonderful to
We have some poets on the radio hour.
And, you know, if you've been a patient, you're allowed to submit. So most of you, if you've had surgery, you qualify. Send it in.
You worked for the Gates Foundation as a writer for a while, and I know you're familiar with their worldwide health efforts. What's the proper role for foundations in this sort of thing? You know, sometimes you get the feeling that the foundations are beginning to take over a lot of things that you normally thought that governments should do. Are we seeing a change in the paradigm here?
I think so. The growth of foundations has been quite explosive in the last few decades, in part driven by some of the accumulated wealth that's occurred in the last few decades. And it's being used for great good around the world, which is wonderful. But there's also, as in every complicated system, quite a long, steep learning curve. And it's very easy to have a concept of what needs to be fixed, and we know how to fix it, and we have the tools, and all we should have to do is take the money and the tools and go over there and fix it. But of course, what you discover is that when you take your values and culture to another country without fully understanding that and incorporating people on the ground in those villages and towns, things can go awry.
As a developing country becomes more advantage, does it create new health problems than when they were just all desperately poor?
I think some are resolved, but some new ones are created as you have more discrepancies. One example might be when suddenly there's money in a community to fund, for instance, a new healthcare clinic that might be focused on taking care of HIV or maternity or TB. That's great. You get this wonderful resource, but it can suck up all the resources that were taking care of just routine care for the impoverished in a country.
I see by your biography that you've done some work in Bhutan.
I have.
What do you do there?
Oh, that's the love of my heart. Once a year, I go with a small team with Global Burn Care. And we take over two plastic surgeons and two anesthesiologists and two nurses and do surgery on patients who've suffered from burns. You may know that in the developing world, burn scars are really quite horrible. They're quite debilitating. They don't have the resources to take care of fresh burns. So if you survive, you're left with a scar that, if it falls across a joint, will completely paralyze that joint. So we go in and do skin grafts to remove the scar tissue and give people a flexible hand or flexible elbow, something they can use.
Your next book deals with polio. Why polio?
Polio, well, I love topics that are not only interesting to research because you live with these for several years, you need to want to do the research, but also that have the capacity to let me go on to multiple levels. And polio is a great disease because it's one of the few we can eradicate, like smallpox. And we've come close several times. There's a huge global movement to do that. But because of cultural and political and economic barriers and misunderstandings, it keeps popping up. For instance, right now in Syria, there's a new outbreak, in part because the Syrian government is using healthcare as a tool of war. They're not allowing the children to be vaccinated, and there's a new outbreak of wild-type polio there.
That's got to be the worst place in the world for a physician to work, I would think.
Well, particularly, Syria was a middle-class country, really, and now you have this 2.2 million refugee population who is living with nothing and no access to everything they used to have at their disposal, hospitals, schools,
playgrounds.
Are
there any doctors left in the country, or have they had to flee?
Not very many.
No. What needs to be done to drive the final stake into the heart of polio? Is it a medical breakthrough? Is it more people, what is it?
It's not a medical breakthrough. We have the tools. It's really a matter of getting into the countries and helping persuade and educate the local population to understand what this vaccine is. It needs to be given in a series. It's not quite as easy as the smallpox vaccine, but as you may know, in places like Pakistan, the Taliban will come in and tell people that this is birth control, and so then you have an outbreak again.
Religion is sometimes the enemy of health, isn't it?
It can be, and other things as well.
We won't get into that. That's probably one we don't want to talk about. The president had trouble with the Pope with that, even, I understand. So what can we say? What is it about medicine, other than the fact that you practice it, that really makes for good stories? Because when a lot of us think about medicine, we don't think about an enjoyable experience, and yet... Yet these books are a good read. How do you manage that?
Thank you. Well, of course, you know, Chuck was driving a stake through my heart with the, you know, I always worry people say she's an anesthesiologist, she's write books, and her books just put you right to sleep and practically smell the fumes coming off the pages. But, well, medicine is just, it's fascinating. I mean, we live with these physical bodies, which are so complicated, and we don't even understand how they work. It's, you know, worse than a new Lexus or something. And we're discovering so much. And the more we discover, the more we discover that we don't know. So, for instance, in my current book, Gemini, I started researching genetics as a mother of two sets of twins. That was pretty fascinating to me. I have one set of fraternal and one set of identical, and yes, they are natural. And not planned, but loved. But at any rate, so I was really interested in our chromosomes and how they define us and how they can dictate so much of our fate. And the more research I did, the more fascinating stuff I discovered. So I just like to translate that for readers.
As a you were raised in Texas, went to the East Coast to go to school, came back this way, and then wound up in the Pacific Northwest. What we have an awful lot of writers who live on these islands around here. What is it?
Yeah, we do, don't we? Part of it, maybe it's jealousy. We see, well, that guy did it. Maybe I can do it. Actually, we're a very friendly group. I am part of this big organization, Seattle 7 Writers, and we're very supportive of each other. You know, people blame the weather. I think it's that we have a reading culture. We live in a reading culture. Look at the number of independent bookstores we have, such as Village Books. You can go to other parts of this country and not find any bookstore, particularly an independent bookstore. I don't think in the Northwest we would ever let that happen.
Do you think that the trend toward more reading on tablets and everything else, electronically, is really a threat to the writers like yourself who write books?
I used to worry about that, but, you know, stories are part of who we are as a culture, as a society, and we're always going to love stories and need stories in our life. The way we digest them, the way we absorb them is going to change. It's been interesting that the ebook adoption rate has now kind of plateaued, and I think we're beginning to see some people need to go back to the book. I'm appalled to say my Visa card is appalled to let you know that I own many books in both the hardback, the paperback, the audiobook, and the ebook.
So which one do you read first?
I like to read the real book by my bedside or at my chair, and then I take the ebook on the plane, and then when I'm out walking or in the car, I listen to the audiobook.
So you're supporting all those industries, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, and if everybody did that for my books, I could educate my four kids. So there you go.
You probably talk to groups of young people as well as adults. What do you find when you talk to them about books and reading and writing? Are they in it at all?
I think they do like to read, and particularly if you look at the number of their books that have been made into movies that are really part of their popular culture. But I get concerned that reading is dying back in number among young people simply because they have so much else that's consuming their time. The digital world, really. It's very distracting. It also disrupts our ability to sit for 2 hours with a book and immerse yourself in someone else's imagination. And I worry that as parents, we're not giving that example. We don't make that a valuable thing to do, sit in the middle of a day with a book.
Well, even as adults, we're so surrounded by electronic stuff that it's really hard sometimes to get away and think. How do you manage that with your heavy schedule?
Well, I'm glad you're assuming that I do. It's hard. I drive. You know, driving is good. Walking is good. Lying awake at night is good. I do that a lot. So
cutting back your schedule at the operating room, probably.
Yeah, yeah. I work half-time now in the operating rooms.
All right. Carol, thanks so much for coming. The book is Gemini, Carol Cassell's latest book.
Thank you very much, Floyd. Thank you all.